Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Juliana Gray. Gray is a graduate of the University of Cincinnati, where she received her PhD in English and creative writing. Her poetry has appeared in many literary journals, including the Hopkins Review, New South, Southern Humanities Review, and Poetry East. She is author of two collections of poetry. Her first, The Man Under My Skin, was published by River City Publishing in 2005, and her most recent is titled Role Play, and it was published by Dream Horse Press in 2012. Juliana Gray is an associate professor in the English department at Alfred University. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, were you introduced to poetry as a young girl, or did it slowly evolve? Tell us.
I was. My father was an English teacher at my high school. He taught English and history, and he encouraged me to read. And by encouraged, I mean he would come into my room and hand me a book and say, read this one now. So there was a lot of poetry involved in that, and fiction as well. But from childhood, I'd say.
Uh-huh. And do you remember when you first tried to write?
I know I did starting around the third grade, because my mother saved one of those early poems and had it expensively matted and framed and presented it to me in public
while
I was in graduate school. That was kind of embarrassing. So I know that it started early. It wasn't very good, but it was there.
Your mother had the foresight to save
she
it, though.
Saved
That's
a lot
amazing.
Of stuff. They were good about that.
Wow. Well, so you're a native of Alabama. I was just wondering, I mean, do you consider yourself a Southern writer? How has the South affected you as a writer?
Definitely a Southern writer. I don't know about, you know, Old South, the way that we think of Southern writers is that kind of Faulknerian cliche. You know, I don't spend too much
time on
it.
Flannery O'Connor.
O'Connor, yeah, more of the O'Connor side. Uh-huh. Less mint juleps and moonlight and more, you know... screechy peacocks. Definitely a Southern writer. I feel really rooted in that place, in that culture.
Well, tell me what that means to you then. I mean, is it rooted to a place and in a flavor?
It is. I think there is just more of a spirit of being a bit more laid back and taking your time. And people always say that the South is a place of storytellers and narrative. So I believe that that's probably true. Definitely better weather than we've enjoyed here in Western New York this winter time. And I know everything's blooming down south, and I'm missing it terribly.
Yeah. There is a flavor of Southern writers telling stories. It's almost like they take more time to do so.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we tell ourselves anyway.
Well, I want to talk about your most recent collection, Role Play, because it's very interesting. You actually do play roles in this.
Right.
And you put yourself in the feet of other characters. Mm-hmm. Tell us where this concept came from.
I like writing persona poems. I teach a class at Alfred University called Dramatis Personae that teaches them how to do that, how to write in the voice of a character. And I find that to be very liberating, that you can write about a subject that interests you, but approach it through this angle of some person who isn't you, and that way you don't have to be embarrassed or self-conscious about saying certain things. And it's just a way to approach a topic from various angles, and I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it must be an interesting challenge. You know, I've interviewed some poets, and they tell people that you shouldn't think that even if personal-sounding poetry is personal sounding, it's not necessarily about me. So.
Right.
But you actually take it one step further and take on roles.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting little puzzle. Can I approach this subject matter maybe in my own voice in this poem, but let me try it again through a character from literature or pop culture or some character that I've invented on my own or from history, pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, like it gives you a wide open field, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I want to have you read a poem from Role Play. This one's called Nancy Drew, 45, posts on Match.com. I love this. This is one of your funnier ones.
Yeah, thank you. I was going for funny, so I'm glad that came across. Okay. Nancy Drew, 45, posts on Match.com. Former girl detective seeks new mystery. Looking for fun and possible LTR. About myself, I'm single, twice divorced, long story short, the high school sweetheart came out of the closet, the father surrogate only wanted to bounce me on his knee. I'm self-employed, still slim and Titian-haired. When I was young, I ran a little wild, chasing after thrills and wicked men, mad to drag the shadows into light. Now I'm home, back in River Heights. I'm tired of danger, of bombs and hot pursuits, of being locked in closets, left for dead, but I miss the rush, holding my breath in the dark, listening for footsteps, feeling my heartbeat race. Maybe, I hope, that's where you come in. You, intrepid, fit, attractive, yes, looks do matter, bright but not a brain, content to let the woman lead the way. If life is like a dark and winding stair, you follow as your lover carries the flashlight. Turn-ons, lightning, crosswords, antique clocks, secluded inns, pineapple daiquiris, pedicures, estate sales, role play, masks. Turn-offs, liars, secrets, drugs, disease, men with ponytails, the B word, guns. Reply with recent pic, kids okay? My heart's a broken locket. Do you hold the other half? Let's investigate.
I love that.
Oh, thank you.
Did that come from a love of Nancy Drew's stories as a kid, or how did that come about?
I was more of a Hardy Boys fan as a kid. I tried Nancy Drew, but nothing ever happened to Nancy. I think they were afraid to have too much violence in those books with a female protagonist. So poor Nancy... they would say, now don't you meddle anymore, and maybe they would lock her in a closet, and her poor boyfriend is the one who got knocked around and got the violence. But I liked the idea of thinking about this sort of plucky, intrepid girl detective character and thinking about whether those qualities would have made her happy when she grew up. And I decided perhaps not.
Well, I was thinking that it was a way to almost give a feminist perception of a character, and also a woman who has lived life.
Yeah, that she's had some experiences, and that she's willing to give it another shot. Here she is at 45, putting it on Match.com. Well, let's try it again.
I love it. So are you trying to tell a story in these poems? Or are you trying to reach emotional places for people? Do you have a philosophy around that?
Well, hopefully a little of both. I mean, I think that poem, I was going for humor, obviously. But that, yeah, there should be some real emotional content in there as well. I think Billy Collins is a good example of that kind of poet who people sometimes dismiss humor as saying, oh, well, that's only funny or it's merely humorous. Mm-hmm. But that he's got some real depth in those poems, too. He's actually got something to say, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Uh-huh. You know, a lot of people use writing, especially poets, to somehow clarify some aspects of their own life. Do you find yourself doing that? Does some of yourself come out in some of these these characters that you're...
I'm not capable of writing a character who isn't a little sarcastic, I'm afraid, so hopefully that doesn't get too repetitive if you read a lot of my poems in a row.
No, I noticed in the book that there's a lot of sarcasm in it, which is probably what we need in this world right now. I mean, things are not necessarily going particularly well.
If you would like some irony or sarcasm, I can supply it.
Yeah, exactly. Then, something I found really interesting, too, because I don't see this very much in poems, is that you use rhyme.
I do.
Quite often. Mm-hmm. Are you attracted to it, or does it just happen that way?
That's something that I sort of was resistant to when I was starting to write, because it felt artificial to me, or it felt old-fashioned. But I've sort of made my peace with it and accumulated a good collection of rhyming dictionaries, and it takes me a lot of time, and I'm still never quite satisfied with how they come out. Sometimes it still feels a bit forced, but I do like the music of it. So I'll use rhyme, especially in a form like a sonnet or something like that, which I really enjoy writing.
I would find rhyming probably limiting for me, because it has to be so deliberate. Even if you can't find the meaning for it, it has to have a specific word.
Yeah, and it can't sound so forced. You know, that Rupp Frost says it has to seem effortless. And you have to put a lot of work into making it seem effortless.
Yeah, and then he was a real pro at that, that's for sure. His stuff still is amazing to me. I want to have you read another from role play. This one does seem more personal. It's called No Song.
Yeah, this one is more personal. We were just talking about the weather. So this is a Western New York poem for sure. All right. No Song. Again the lilacs bloom. The hillsides turn a tender golden green. Woodpeckers send out their firmly worded telegrams. The greater part of our reflexive joy is sheer relief that winter has an end, that spring returns, the world has not died forever. The little lake is mirror still, a goose adrift in its false blue sky. We prefer to think of beauty now, banal and commonplace as it is, as much as horror, which even sunstruck days such as this assuredly contain.
That's a beautiful one.
Oh, thank you.
Did you write that from a memory, or were you actually sitting somewhere watching nature? It seems very contemplative.
Well, this is probably a reason why maybe you shouldn't explain your poems, because it's going to sound so mundane. But I was I was driving to get my hair cut, just going to a hair appointment, and driving through near Wellsville, New York, and past this little scene where there was a lake and some geese and ducks on it. And it was a beautiful day, but I was in sort of a crabby mood, I guess, and decided, yeah, well, the beauty doesn't really mean anything. The world is still a dark place. So that's a very Western New York outlook, at least for me as a transplanted Southerner.
I love that, too, that it shows people that you can find poetry and art anywhere.
Yeah.
Driving for a haircut, going to the store for a quart of milk, you know.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I had to learn to teach myself as a poet, was not to shut down an idea too quickly or dismiss it as trivial or, you know, that's dumb or whatever, but to try writing it out and see what happens. And maybe it doesn't work, but then maybe it will.
Yeah. And a lot of writers talk to me about how, you know, one of the first things that a young writer needs to learn is how to not be afraid.
Right.
To go for it no matter what.
Yeah, you've got to take some risks. And they're not always going to work.
Yeah, and not to censor yourself.
Right.
Because you don't have to show the world everything you write.
Oh, definitely not. Lock that stuff away.
to tell me how living in the East has changed you, though. Because you said you consider yourself a Southern writer. Has something opened up or shut down by being here?
Well, definitely there's a lot more snow and ice imagery in my poems. That wasn't there before. Fewer azaleas, less honeysuckle. I don't know. I think maybe in a way it was helpful. I still write about the South, and I think not living there anymore gives me maybe a clearer perspective on what it's like. But also, you know, there is some baggage that comes with being a Southern writer, and you know, there are certain subjects or themes that people sort of expect you to address. So getting away from that, I think also has been a little liberating. You know, I don't think anybody expects me to necessarily write any more poems about kudzu. I've done that. It's over. You know.
Yeah.
But I do a little Southern outreach with my Northern friends up here. I've made okra for them, trying to convince them that it's actually delicious.
That would be a hard one for me. That's, you know, I'm a vegetable freak, but I cannot stand okra.
Oh, you haven't
texture.
Had it at my house.
It's the texture. Tell me how you work on a poem. Does it vary? Does it take a long time? Do you deliberate or let it sit? Tell us.
On the good days, they come quickly, but that doesn't always happen. Usually I'll get an idea, and it may be a line or it may be an image or something like that, and I have to let it sort of percolate in my head until I've got a few lines. And they may be the last line, they may be the first line. It just has to build in my mind until I'm ready to write it down. So I think there was a line, I want to say it was from Rita Dove, that she said once that she only types at the typewriter, she writes all over the house.
Ah.
So you're always thinking about what you're working on and sort of composing in your head. So that's what I like to do. I think I know some people sit down in front of the blank page every day. That would not work for me, just staring at a blank white screen. I have to know where I'm going before I set out. And then once I do, the first draft usually comes out in a couple hours. It'll need to be revised. Who knows how many times after that. But that first little burst is that's a good day.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Juliana Gray. We're talking about her most recent book, Role Play. Now, I do want to have you read another from Role Play. This one's called The House Sitter's Note.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I found this one really haunting. And you know, you can tell us a little bit about it before you read it or after. Either way, but I want to talk to you a bit about it.
Let's do it after. I'll go ahead and be haunting first. All right. The House Sitter's Note. Welcome home. I hope your trip was fun. Around here, things were quiet. The plants did very well, except the potted basil, which wilted every day like it wanted to die. I put it in the ground beside the porch. Hope that's okay with you. The cats and I were instant friends. They'd curl up on my lap or on my legs while I stretched out on your couch and read your magazines. They slept with me at night in your bed. When I ran out of clothes, I wanted to borrow some of yours, but they were kind of snug. I lost 11 pounds, eating only your salad, drinking your tea. I chopped the toes out of your shoes. The mail is on the table. I took the liberty of writing to your teenage son at camp. His letter sounded lonely, and even though he's far too shy, like you, to come right out and say so, I think he had a wicked crush on a counselor who's much too old for him. I told him that we loved him, enclosed a 10. When I got the midnight call that your dad had died, I took the car, your good Kentucky bourbon, and drove out to the lake. I wept and drank that warm bitterness, and when I smashed the bottle on the rocks, the bits of glass arced across the headlight's yellow beam like far-off shooting stars. Finally, surrounded by the photographs of your friends and loved ones, I softly passed away in your bed. It's all right. It was my time to go. And now you'd never know that I was there in your tidy house, your green and purring space, except for a ghost of bourbon in the air and, on your pillow, a single foreign strand.
That is a very strange piece. I
yes.
loved it.
Thank you.
I absolutely loved it. Where did it come from?
From house-sitting for a friend. He and his family had a basil plant in the kitchen, and every single time when I went over there, that basil plant was hideously wilted, even though I had watered it, and I wanted to plant it in the ground outside, thinking it would do better in the soil. And I started wondering, well, that's a little presumptuous, it's not my house, and then that idea sort of kicked in about a house sitter who would sort of gradually start taking those liberties and inserting him or herself into the life of the people that they were house sitting for.
Wow, it sounds like one of those horror movies, you know?
Well, yes.
Remember that one single white female where Jennifer
Jason Leigh
and then tried to become her roommate?
Yeah. That's
living her life, even? That's what this poem reminded me of.
Yeah, a little bit of that. And you know, speaking of being a Southern writer, a little Rose for Emily slips in there at the end with the hair on the pillow. I just couldn't resist it.
Wow, that was quite a poem to me. I found it really quite interesting.
Yeah, thanks. That's a funny one. Sometimes at readings, people laugh. They find that a humorous poem, and sometimes they don't.
Oh.
So, I don't know.
Well, I think in terms of people searching for identities, I found it really quite sinister and true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. in this culture, especially on the internet, people pretending
right.
like they're different people.
Right, privacy concerns.
And probably not even knowing who they are, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to talk about the fact that you worked for 13 years as a staffer for the
Sawanee Writers Conference.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to mispronounce that one.
Yeah.
What was that? What was that like?
Oh, it's terrific. It's in Sawanee, Tennessee at the University of the South. It's a 12-day conference, and it varies from day to day, but there's usually about 200 writers on the campus. There are Pulitzer Prize winners and Poets Laureate teaching the workshops. There is faculty, and then they've got emerging writers, people with just one or two books as fellows. There are scholars who are just starting to publish. There are participants who are still learning the ropes. Everybody's mingling together, sharing a table at dinner and hearing readings and panels and
wow.
just having a wonderful time for 12 days.
Wow, what an eye-opener for an emerging writer, especially to be able to be in that company.
Yeah, oh, it's an amazing experience.
Do you think it's important for writers to connect with other writers and go to conferences? And do you recommend that to writers?
I do, because writing can otherwise get so lonely. My students ask why everything that we read is depressing, and I tell them that writers generally are not the happiest people. If they were happy people, they wouldn't want to spend all day by themselves in a room. They would be out having fun. So it can get a little lonely, and you can, you know, start to question yourself and doubt what you're doing, but if you go and become part of a community of writers, even for a short time like that, make some friends, make some connections, I think that can really be invigorating.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it happen time in, time out.
But, it seems to me that most writers aren't that isolated now. I mean, we are mm-hmm. living our lives. We have relationships. And a lot of writers have kids.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that image of somebody sitting in a room all by themselves feeling suicidal and,
and
feeling lonely. Because it doesn't seem like anybody can write anymore that way.
Yeah. Well, the writing part of it, though, I mean, that has to be
the actual execution of the right. ideas, yeah.
Yeah, so it's helpful to, to have a reader that you can show it to and say, is this okay? Am I on the right track? Am I fooling myself here?
Yeah.
So going to a conference or just having a book group or a writer's group in a town, that sort of thing can be really, really helpful.
Yeah. Well, what do you tell emerging writers and writers that you teach in mm-hmm. regard to having a career as a writer? Do you have advice?
I don't really talk much about having a career. I'm more interested in the quality of the writing. At Alfred University, I teach undergraduates, so they're not there yet. They're not mm-hmm. at the stage where you would be looking for a career or trying to publish a novel or a collection of poetry or anything like that. I think it's more important to write well and then think about having a career or becoming a professor of writing or something like that. But to get the craft under control first and figure out what you're doing and make good literature.
Yeah, giving them the tools, indeed, just to even see if they even want to pursue it.
Right, yeah, but, you may not.
Yeah. Do you feel, as a professor, that you can tell somebody, I don't think you're cut out for this? Do you ever discourage people?
Well, they rarely ask, and if the student doesn't directly ask me, I'm not going to offer it, from my seat of lofty wisdom as their professor. That feels really presumptuous. I have had a couple of students who are very talented, and I've taken them aside and said, you really should pursue this thing, if you want to, if you're interested, I think you could make something of yourself. But, I think back on my own poems that I wrote when I was an undergraduate, they were not very good.
Mm-hmm.
It took years of taking more classes in graduate school and writing on my own and just sheer mm-hmm. trial and error.
And just living life.
Yeah, right, growing up.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't be too eager to crush their hopes.
I think that's a good idea. I have talked to some people who have been crushed, not just writers, but artists, saying, well, you better go learn a skill, I think that is the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
Role play. Mm. This one's called Cutters. I find this one really, really fascinating and scary, too.
Good. I think this one's supposed to be scary. Yeah. Cutters. Some girls fall in love with scissors. Some girls whisper secrets to a sweet little paring knife filched from their mother's kitchen drawer. Some girls keep a razor blade in their tidy billfolds, tucked among their ticket stubs and mad money. They wear long sleeves and knee-length skirts. They keep the doors to their bedrooms closed. The bright edge, the clean release, the crimson kiss that stays with them reminds them with a pang each time they bend or cross their legs that they are loved. How can the girls say no? Some girls don't know when to stop.
Wow, where did that come from?
That came from teaching at the Sewanee Young Writers Conference, which meets a couple of weeks before the what we tend to call the Adult Writers Conference, but that makes it sound like we're doing a different kind of writing. And that's another, I think it's a 10-day conference for high school students between 15 and 17, and I taught at that conference for, I think, 11 years. It was a really terrific experience, but a lot of the students, we were just talking about writers being lonely, a lot of those young writers felt very alienated and isolated in their high schools. They were very sensitive, and they would write poems about self-harm. Uh-huh. Some of them cut themselves.
Yeah.
And I felt for them and didn't really know what I could do for them, except maybe to write something uh-huh. about why they would do such a thing.
Uh-huh. And then, so have you shared this poem with audiences where people have come up to you and related to it?
Nobody's volunteered. Mm-hmm. I think that's something really personal. So nobody's come up and said, oh, I've done that. Mm-hmm. But people do seem to respond to that poem. I think even if they don't want to share themselves, I think a lot of readers do know someone who has harmed themselves or attempted to harm themselves.
And, oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, now you can talk about eating disorders, cutting,
right.
all those things are, right. have to do with self-harm and mm-hmm. self-esteem and all kinds of different issues. Yeah,
yeah. It was mostly the girls at the Young Writers Conference who would cut themselves, and they would want to talk about it and write about it, but they just didn't quite know how and couldn't articulate what it meant. So I guess that was my attempt to do so.
Yeah, that's an incredible poem. I hope it goes on and gets published someplace where people might be able to see it who need to see it.
Yeah.
How important do you think live performance is for poets? Is that something that you really encourage writers to develop, a way to speak in public?
Yeah, I think it's a good skill to have, just public speaking in general. And reading a poem is a good way to practice because you're not expected to just, extemporize and mm-hmm. Perform some kind of oratory feat right off the cuff. You actually can look down at the page, but that you do have to try to connect with an audience, and make the eye contact and control the pitch of your voice. I'm always, I like to encourage our students to go to things like open mics and participate in things like that, even if they're not super confident. And I always have to remind them to slow down and don't let your voice fall at the end and that sort of thing. But I think it helps build some confidence in your speaking as well as in your writing to present it to others.
Yeah. And I've talked to a lot of poets who do think poetry is an oral mm-hmm. art and it's meant to be read aloud. And
definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you hear the music. You hear the meter or the rhyme or the sound effects like alliteration or mm-hmm. whatever else is going on in there. And you take in a poem two different ways if you read it aloud. You're scanning it with your eye and you're taking it in with your ear and it's moving through your body as you pronounce it. So it's a much different experience mm-hmm. to read it out loud.
You know, I think we have time and I want to mm-hmm. have you read... Suspicion. Mm-hmm. And this is from a section called Box Set, and it's mm-hmm. all based on Hitchcock films.
Right.
So I found this really quite fascinating. This is one of my favorite ones, too.
Yeah, this is the movie with Cary Grant and, I forget the actress in the lead, but she's married Cary Grant, and then she starts to suspect maybe he's not the man that she thinks he is, and is he trying to kill her for insurance money, or is he, just kind of a buffoon? So, and hence the title of Suspicion. The glass of milk glows, a spot of light on the darkened stair, like a small moon on a silver tray. The husband's face is shadowed as he carries the milk, white as arsenic, taking each step with such deliberate slowness he doesn't spill a luminous drop. His wife upstairs no longer knows who she married. Is he lazy but honest? Is he a murderer? That glass of milk, it glows. Twilight, the ambivalent hour between day and night, between dog and wolf. Suspicion climbs the stairs. She'll have to drink to know whose teeth are kissing her throat.
That's great. Well, Juliana Gray, we're almost out of time. Can you give some contact information? Let us know if you're going to give any readings in the near future.
You can find me at the Alfred University website, alfred.edu. If you Google me or do a search on that page, you can find my email address there. I don't think I have any more readings lined up in Western New York anytime soon. I think my next appearance is at the Alabama Book Festival next month. I'll be going back home and my accent will return.
Well, Juliana Gray, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of your work
with us.
This has been a great pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
And again, Juliana Gray is a poet, and we were talking about her book, Role Play. Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.